For a long time, the United States refused to deal independently with North Korea. I'd say the Bush administration is responsible for changing that, and I think that was a wise move. Now that this is being continued by the Clinton administration, and at least the United States is succeeding in working out its main agenda item, which is the nuclear question, the South Koreans are beginning to feel left out.
Prospects for the Korean Peninsula on this edition of Common Ground. Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. The situation in Korea is one of the last vestiges of Cold War politics. Since the end of World War II, when the temporary division of the country became permanent, South Korea has been associated with the U.S., North Korea with the communist world. While the Korean Peninsula is of strategic importance to the United States, we actually hear little about the country until a crisis erupts. And that was the case this spring and summer when there was great tension about North Korea's suspected nuclear weapons program and then the death of the North's longtime leader, Kim Il-sung. But my guest today, James Pillay, who is director of the Center for Korean Studies at the University of Washington, believes that crisis was overblown.
In my opinion, the crisis was manufactured in the Bush administration by the origin of the debate over North Korean nuclear weapons. And prior to that time, both North and South Korea were making some progress in working out arrangements for the mutual exchange of business personnel, entertainers, sports teams, and things of that nature. But the Bush administration created a problem with the expectation that North Korea was in the middle of a nuclear weapons program and put that at the top of the agenda in American-Korean relations. Since that time, we've had a crisis was reached until it was defused by the actions of Jimmy Carter, who went over to visit Kim Il-sung before he passed away. And both Kim Il-sung and Jimmy Carter announced that they'd solved the problem. And, of course, then Kim Il-sung died. But ever since Jimmy Carter's visit, the crisis has disappeared from the pages of the American newspapers. And currently, the United States and North Korea are involved in independent one-on-one negotiations to work out some type of a system that will satisfy American demands on at least keeping the nuclear program at the current stage. The United States has not been able to obtain agreement on the part of the North Koreans to open up and reveal information about what they've been able to accomplish thus far, but the United States government under Clinton has been willing to accept the North Korean statement by Kim Jong-il, the son of Kim Il-sung, that it will no longer proceed with its nuclear development policy and will just stay in place with what it has. Right now, I would say that there's one problem has been introduced into this. The South Korean government has reacted. They think that the Americans are moving too fast and that South Korea is being left out of the negotiations. So foreign minister of South Korea, Han Sung-ju, just completed a trip to Washington, D.C., where he insisted that the United States make as a precondition for the continued negotiations with the North the acceptance of South Korean demands for joint talks between North and South Korea. Unfortunately, that was just the issue that blocked the previous advance between the U.S. and North Korean talks, because the North Koreans, I'd say, purposely botched the previous North-South talks because they basically did not want to deal with the South Koreans.
What is the attitude of the South Koreans in general towards the United States? Does it feel like it's at the whim of whatever U.S. policy is, and is that part of this feeling of being left out?
Recently, that has been just a problem. For a long time, the United States refused to deal independently with North Korea. I'd say the Bush administration is responsible for changing that, and I think that was a wise move because it gave the United States much more flexibility than it had in the past. Now that this is being continued by the Clinton administration, and at least the United States is succeeding in working out its main agenda item, which is the nuclear question, the South Koreans are beginning to feel left out, and with some justification in one respect and with no justification on the other. They have justification because the United States is placing the nuclear question above the reunification issue, and the South Koreans claim that from their perspective, reunification is the primary problem and not the nuclear question. I happen to agree with them on that particular point. Where they are not justified is that it's South Korean policy in the last last 6 months or so that has actually made the possibility of North-South direct talks very difficult. And why? Because the South Koreans are in the middle of a campaign to root out every vestige of communist and left-wing thinking that still exists in South Korea, and they're doing it by the using what I would regard as an unconstitutional national security law, which means that anybody that says something nice about North Korea or praises North Korea in any way is guilty of treason. And they're routing out every single student who has been interested in the reunification movement and who've been interested in, let's say, Kim Il-sung or the thought of Juche, as to say the North Korean line of independence. They're trying to route these people right out of the university system and throw them all in jail. At the same time, the South Koreans have not refused to send any envoy to commiserate with the passing of Kim Il-sung. Those items have antagonized the North Koreans to the point where they don't want to deal with the South Koreans right now. So for the South Koreans to insist that direct North-South talks be resuscitated as a precondition for the continuation of U.S.-North Korean talks is a surefire formula for interrupting the progress that's being made.
How serious do you think the threat was earlier this year regarding North Korea's nuclear weapons program, and why at that time was the issue raised? And raised to such levels that there was actually a lot of speculation about the possibility of a second Korean War involving the U.S.
Well, I think the major reason probably is the rethinking of American policy after the collapse of communism. With communism no longer the major issue around the globe, probably the major thinking, I would think, well, there's two major aspects to the problem with respect to the Korean Peninsula. One is nonproliferation. The attempt of the United States not only to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons to small countries around the globe, particularly unfriendly countries like Libya, Iraq, and Iran, but also to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists. And that's become a major problem in, I think, American diplomatic thinking. And if the North Koreans, well, people suspected that the North Koreans were trying to make their nuclear weapons because they had these nuclear plants for energy that is a byproduct of producing plutonium. So people must have realized that fact and felt that it was important to take North Korea out of the nuclear business or to restrict their potential for making weapons. The second part is maintaining American interests in the Far East. And the most crucial item there is Japan, the defense of Japan. Now, the United States has been underwriting and, well, taking responsibility for Japanese defense ever since the end of World War II. As a matter of fact, the United States built in Article 9 in the Japanese Constitution that forbids the rearmament of Japan. They're afraid that if the North Koreans were to develop nuclear weapons, it would scare the Japanese government to the point where they would abrogate Article 9 and begin a rearmament policy. And once Japan becomes rearmed, they will become a superpower in no time flat. So I think the Americans are concerned more with, A, the defense of Japan, B, the reaction of Japan to a nuclear weapon, and the creation of not only a rearmed Japan, but a re-imperialized Japan. I think those two issues are the main problems that have been activating American policy and also explains why they're more important to American policymakers than the reunification of Korea peacefully.
Do you think, given the death of Kim Il-sung this summer, that there is a current window of opportunity for improving both bilateral relations with North Korea, between the U.S. and North Korea, and also, say, for North and South Korea? Is that being pursued?
I think it's the opportunities have already appeared. The North Koreans have eased their stance, have taken a more lenient attitude. They're willing to compromise with the United States. Right now, they're not willing to allow full inspection of their past activities, but they're willing to allow international inspection of their future activities. I think that's more than sufficient for the United States to be satisfied with that kind of a formula. And I think it provides the basis for, I would say the next step would be to attempt to expand trade relations with North Korea. And the chief obstacle to that is the South Korean government right now. You might think that the South Korean government should know better because Kim Il-sung, the president, was in the opposition for most of his political career and suffered under the same National Security Act that he's using to repress the minuscule left wing in South Korea. Nonetheless, the South Korean government is becoming a very reactionary force. On the one hand, they say they want reunification, but on the other hand, they're instituting anti-communist, anti-left-wing policies, which means that they, as long as they continue to do that, they're an obstructive force. And I would say the United States should press right ahead with its current policy, no matter what the South Koreans do on this question. Eventually, the hope is that they'll come around on this point.
Is North Korea just as virulent in rooting out any sort of anti-government thought?
I think they are. They've got a lot of people, a lot of political criminals in jail. They do not tolerate any kind of open criticism of the regime. They do not allow anybody inside to see what's going on, so it's very difficult to pin this down. You only have occasional people who escape or who are let out of jail who testify to the number of political criminals in North Korea. They also run a very tight ship when people are sent abroad. Whether it's the diplomats or whatever, or officials, they always have a secret service agent going alongside with them. So I'd say the North Koreans are probably much more oppressive than the South Koreans are. What makes it anomalous in the case of South Korea is that the current president was in the past, for most of his life, the victim of this type of repression. But because he abandoned his oppositional ways and joined the government, he has now taken on the aura of a repressive regime. What makes it even more anomalous is that elections now are as free as they have ever been in South Korea. And the left-wing parties, the Minjungdang, a mass party that ran in the last major election, was not able to garner enough votes even to constitute itself under the law as a legitimate party with a formal representation in the National Assembly. In other words, there is not sufficient voter sentiment or voter approval of the extreme left-wing line in South Korea to even make a party or even elect a representative to the National Assembly.
So how extreme was that left-wing? I mean, what was their basic platform?
Well, actually, their announced platform was not as radical as some of these students are. They call themselves a mass party, and they basically were... Their policy was designed to represent the interests of several groups. The low-wage workers, the unemployed, and the homeless, and also the small-holding farmer or peasant population in the countryside, against the interests of big business and the chaebol or cartels and the government at the center. So that was basically their announced policy. They steered away from class analysis and class struggle. They did not include class struggle in part of their ideological announcements or their platform. But even that, I would say it's a kind of a mild kind of populism. You could call it the left-wing populism. But even that was not sufficient to appeal to a large segment of the South Korean population. So what's taking place now is the concoction by certain elements of the Korean elite and the Korean government of a serious communist threat when, I would say, just simply opening up the country to free speech is the best way to handle that. And I also would add what they ought to do is abolish the national security law, which is unconstitutional to begin with and constitutes a violation of civil liberties.
Listening to Common Ground, it's a program on world affairs sponsored by the Stanley Foundation, a My guest is James Pillay, director of the Center for Korean Studies at the University of Washington in Seattle. Professor Pillay is the founding editor of the Journal of Korean Studies and general editor for four volumes of the Cambridge History of Korea. The Stanley Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to promote thought and dialogue about the world. Tapes and transcripts of Common Ground programs are available. Please listen at the end of the broadcast for details on ordering. Well, we've been talking, or you've mentioned several times this possibility of reunification, and just a few years ago, top leaders in North and South Korea were predicting that they would be reunified by the middle of this decade. What's happened to the momentum for reunification?
Well, you're talking about North Korean statements to the effect of reunification. Well, mm-hmm. a lot of that was propaganda that had no meaning in effect. I think the best prospects for reunification were the talks that were taking place before the emergence of the nuclear question, of North Korea's nuclear capacity. That issue was raised by the United States, and not by the Koreans. And had that nuclear question not been raised, progress would have been made between North and South Korea on the exchange of business personnel. You know, a lot of these chaebol or cartels in South Korea were very interested in investing in North Korea for a number of reasons. Resort towns or free trade areas or areas where South Korean businessmen would build factories and use North Korean labor for exports of goods abroad. There's still a lot of enthusiasm for that, and that could be resuscitated, I think, fairly rapidly once the nuclear issue was put aside. But it would also require the South Koreans to ease off on their repressive policies against their own population. So I think progress was being made on that score and could be made in the future.
How important is reunification to the people of the two Koreas?
Intellectually, it's important to almost every Korean. But there are a number of those in the there are many people in both North and South who are afraid of the consequences of a reunification or any steps leading toward the reunification. The North in particular has been able to exist by closing itself off to the outside world and maintaining tight control, not only over the economy, over the distribution of wealth, but also ideas. And by maintaining that kind of tight control, even against the Chinese and the Russians, they were able to perpetuate their regime and maintain stability. Matter of fact, as long as they continue to do that, they may be able to persist, but they will be condemned indefinitely to a low level of technology because they will not benefit from the competitive situation in the world economy. On the other hand, in the South, in other words, if they open up, they're afraid that their whole system might collapse because of outside contact. The South, likewise, is also afraid of infiltration of left-wing radical communist ideas inside South Korea, which explains why the South Koreans are presently engaged in a McCarthyite campaign against the remaining left-wing elements among the student population. Because there are, you know, it's part of the whole, part of the problem of capitalism, particularly oligopolistic capitalism, which prevails in South Korea, in which a couple of dozen huge companies control the economy, up until recently at the direction of the government. But nonetheless, it's created a lot of areas of discontent and a lot of hostility. And they're afraid that these weaknesses in their own system is likely to lead to a left-wing revolutionary movement. So both sides have fears that any type of opening or accommodation or unification is going to lead to either internal subversion or possibly a weaken South Korea and bring on a North Korean invasion, which I think is very unlikely. I really think that both North and South are armed for defense at the present time.
Well, just a few years ago, we saw the reunification of the two Germanys. Is that a possible model for North and South Korea?
Yeah, I don't think that even the Koreans themselves, a lot of the South Koreans who are conservative, do not want the German solution. The German solution, which is absorption, means that you take over North Korea. But it doesn't. They're not thinking about politics. They're thinking about the cost involved. And since the North Korean economy is not competitive on an international basis, their technology is out of date. You'd have to reinvest in almost the reindustrialization of North Korea to a large extent. You could use their labor power, but it would take a big dent out of the South Korean budget. So there's a lot of people opposed to that. The North Koreans they don't like the idea at all. They're totally opposed to this. Their formula for reunification has long been a federation of sorts where both North and South Korea maintain independence. Matter of fact, anybody in South Korea who advocates the federation line for reunification is liable for prosecution in violation of the National Security Act. The current government that's currently throwing these students in jail cites this particular thing. So anybody who advocates a federated reunification plan is just hawking the North Korean line and guilty of treason. Nonetheless, I don't see any other alternative besides that. Unfortunately, that was Kim Il-sung's policy for most of his career, reunification through a federation agreement, particularly after he dropped the idea that he was going to reunify Korea by force. But it's so the likelihood of that kind of approach, which I think is not a bad one, is weak. I don't think there's going to be a German-style reunification that takes place. But the most interesting prospect, I would think, would be something like an approach that's similar to American policy towards China. Chinese refuse to budge very much on political amelioration, on human rights or anything of that nature. But they're more than happy to begin a kind of, I don't know what you call it, socialistic capitalism or what have you. And they're trying to open their market. They're trying to join the world community. That may be a better approach. You know, if you drag the North Koreans into the world system, allow them to sell their goods, let them enter into trading relationships under any arrangements they're willing to allow, that's a better way to reduce tensions than any other way. Now, what that might lead to in the future is hard to say. But I think that's a good first step if they adopted the same policy to North Korea that we have towards China.
And is that what North Korea has wanted?
I believe so. Although there's been a lot of talk in the South Korean press about a so-called two-line struggle taking place. It's not commentators or the experts in South Korea are not quite clear. They can't quite figure out themselves which one of these two lines in North Korea actually has predominance. But after reading a lot of material in the last couple of months, I think that the consensus of opinion is that that Kim Jong-il, who is now in charge of the government, is more open towards increased business activity between North Korea and the outside world, and even between North Korea and South Korea when it comes to business opportunities, than even Kim Il-sung was. They've gone into his past and his past history and his associations, and they think he's been associated with a lot of people who have been talking what you might call a liberal line from the standpoint of North Korea, which is opening trade with the South, with businessmen from the South, with the United States and with other countries. So if he had his way, if he could put the nuclear issue out of the way, if he could get the South Koreans to desist from their current anti-communist campaign, it might be possible to open up some type of a friendly relationship between North and South.
Yeah, back to the issue of South Korea's lack of democracy. Given the U.S. influence on South Korea, do you think the U.S. has pursued democratization in South Korea hard enough?
Well, the Clinton administration has been somewhat better than the Bush and Reagan administrations on this point. The Clinton administration has openly stated that South Korea ought to abrogate or eliminate its national security law, but they're not pushing it. It's not the most advertised. The press in the United States doesn't pick up on this at all. But I think that in doing so, I think the Clinton administration has been on the right track, and I would give them credit for doing so. But I'm not sure that the democratization is the only issue involved. The other bigger issue is the fact that the United States is consumed primarily with solving the nuclear question, and reunification is a subordinate issue. Actually, the interesting thing about the South Koreans is they're complaining. They say that the primary issue ought to be reunification, or better, friendlier relations between North and South Korea. And they think the only way to do this is by having direct talks between the North and the South Koreans, particularly on the nuclear issue. The South Koreans are willing, South Korean government is willing to provide a light water reactor to replace the carbon reactors that are being used in North Korea. The North Koreans refuse to accept South Korean light water reactors. They're thumbing their nose at the South Koreans. They say, well, we'd rather have a Russian design. The Americans have compromised on that and said, well, maybe we can get a German light water reactor. When the South Koreans saw that, they hit the ceiling. You know, were they going to use German reactors? And we're trying to work out some kind of peaceful accommodation with North Korea. And they reacted sharply to this, and they sent their foreign minister to Washington, D.C. Well, the issue of which country makes the light water reactor, I'd say, is beside the point. I'm sure the South Koreans want to do it, but they also want to do it so they can use it as leverage on the North Koreans. If they supply the North Koreans with a light water reactor, they will also have to supply expertise and parts for the operation of that light water reactor. My guess is the North Koreans don't want to be under the thumb of the South Koreans. So that it makes some sense as to, you can understand the North Korean objection to this.
Well, even if the U.S. hasn't placed its highest priority on reunification, do you think that since the United States and the former Soviet Union drew the line that divided Korea right after World War II, that they bear a great responsibility in reuniting the Koreas?
I think they do, but there are very few Russians and Americans who feel that they have a responsibility to do that. And I would say primarily because American diplomats and also much of the commentary in the press and elsewhere thinks that diplomacy should only be done or conducted on the basis of interests. If the Americans have interests, they should pursue those interests, defend those interests. If there's no interest, do nothing. You can draw an analogy with the Haiti situation. A lot of people are opposed to an invasion of Haiti because we have no interest. It doesn't affect American security. The moral issue stirs up some people, maybe even Clinton himself, I think. But a lot of critics of his policy say if there are no interests involved, you shouldn't get involved in Haiti. There should be no invasion. I think the same mode of thought applies to Korea as well. If there's no threat to American security, leave the status quo as is. In other words, leave Korea permanently divided ad infinitum, because that's the best way to guarantee not only American security, but the security of America's far-flung interests in the Far East. That is to say, both the defense of Japan and the continued demilitarization of Japan.
Professor James Pillay has been my guest on Common Ground. He's director of the Center for Korean Studies at the University of Washington in Seattle and teaches at the Jackson School of International Studies at the university. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you'd like to order a tape or transcript of this program about the two Koreas, you can call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. Cassettes cost $9.95 plus shipping and handling, and transcripts are $5 apiece. For more information about the Stanley Foundation, or to send us your comments about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free phone number to order cassettes is 1-800-825-5746. Was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground is produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.